A wave of grief rolls over me like a tsunami, only 19 fucking years old. When I reach her, I see that she tangled herself into the lines to keep herself afloat. She's lying on top of a watery grave, waiting for someone to find her. Jesus, sweetheart, I'm sorry. My hands are stiff and numb from the cold as I untangle her body. For a second, emotions threaten to overwhelm me. My fingers push under her jaw, feeling for a pulse. Nothing. Her skin is cold and waxy under my fingertips. The anguished sounds I make hurt my ears. They're more animal than human. Shane is calling to me, but I can't make out the words. All I hear are the sounds of my own grief and my harsh breath. You can't break down. Not yet. You have to get her body on the yacht. You have to. Do not quit. It takes all my muddled concentration. The cold has me in its grip. My fingers are stiff and clumsy. But if she slips from my hands, she'll sink to the bottom of the river and I'll never find her again. My muscles cramp and lactate burns inside them. It's like I've been running for hours. Finally, I hook her under the arms so her back is against my chest and her head is tilted against the life ring. I kick numbly, but Shane's doing the lion's share of the work. Slowly, Cameron and I are pulled away from the buoys into the open water. It feels like forever before we reach the side of the ship. I tie the line around her, pull her body up, Shane. I don't take my eyes off of her until she disappears over the side. Then I swim to the ladder. The first time I try to climb out, my freezing fingers can't hold on, and I fall like a boulder back into the water. I'm under, and it takes me too long to surface. It's hard to catch my breath, hard to move my legs at all. "Tie the line around you," Shane shouts, dropping the life preserver. I thread the rope under my arms and knot it around my chest, then I grab the bars again. Shane pulls like he's deadlifting. I wrap my forearm around a bar to lock myself in place before each step. My feet slip a couple of times, but I force myself to keep going. There are sharp pains, like icicles, driving into the soles of my feet. I keep going, gritting my teeth. It fucking hurts. Every rung is agony. Shane keeps pulling. Under my sagging weight, the rope is taut, making it even harder to breathe. When I'm near the top, he grabs the length of rope that's against my chest and heaves. I push off the rungs too, as hard as I'm able to. I land on the deck like a fucking shark that's been towed in on a fishing line. Check for a pulse, Shane. I didn't feel one. But maybe. My throat burns. I could have been wrong. It was hard to feel anything. My fingers were so cold. Please, let me be wrong. In my peripheral vision, I watch him kneel above her. He lays his fingers under her jaw, his face a grim mask. For several excruciating moments, he waits, repositions them, and waits again. I pray, barely breathing, hoping against hope. "I'm sorry, Deck. She's gone. Please, no." In an instant, it all closes in, narrowing the world to the pain in my chest. Our time together flashes before my eyes. I wanted to make more memories with her. We were supposed to have time. "Oh, God," I whisper, my voice sounding weak and distant. This is not like being hit on the football field or in a fight. This is like getting a leg caught in the chain of an anchor and being dragged down to the bottom of the icy ocean. Every inch of skin hurts. My lungs burn. The life is slowly being crushed out of me until there's nothing left. No fight. No hope. Nothing. "Can you do one more thing for me, Shane?" I ask in a ragged whisper. "Yeah." "Can you take her body into the cabin and put it on the bed and cover her up?" My voice cracks. "Fuck." I cover my face because I can't stop myself. A fucking sob escapes. "I need a minute. Oh God, how did I let this happen again?" I'm crying when Shane picks her up and takes her away. And the tears are still leaking out of the corners of my eyes and running down my temples when he returns to cover me with a blanket. Shane kneels next to me, leaning down. "I know it's bad. I know." He grips my shoulder through the blanket. "But you can't stay on deck. It's too fucking cold out here. He looks around and blows out a breath. Come on, he says, lifting my arm and trying to get me to clasp his hand so he can help me up. I know it's hard, man. You can take as long as you want once you're near Ahita. I'm all right. My voice sounds weak and lost. I've never heard it sound like this. Even during my mom's funeral, I put up a better front. This time, though, I know what's in store. Guilt and regret will grind me down until nothing matters, until I'm empty. Declan, come on, Shane says, his voice harsher. Are you really going to make me carry you? Soon, you'll have nothing but time to grieve. But you don't have it now. Get up. Get your friend back to shore. It takes everything I've got to make the words sound halfway steady. Help me sit up. Yeah. Here we go. He grabs the line that's still around my chest and pulls it to get me upright. Rubbing my eyes, I take a deep breath. I'm all right. I'll get us back to shore. I pull the rope off my chest and roll onto my hands and knees. From there, I regain my feet. Even half frozen, muscle memory takes over. Wrapped in the blanket, I shuffle across the deck. Once I'm out of the wind and next to the heater, feeling returns to my fingers. Shane brings my clothes. My aunt leaves the area when ordered to, and I drop my boxer briefs and pull on my dry clothes. My teeth chatter as I up anchor and turn the yacht back toward shore. Lizzie appears in the doorway. Why was she naked? I demand. What was done to her before she went into the water? Oh, God, no. Nothing like that. The clothes were cut off to make it look like the serial killer, the other serial killer. Is that what you mean? Because you're a serial killer yourself. My mom, my girlfriend, is that it? Or are there others that you've murdered? Quiet, she says, shushing me. Family business is family business, not for outsiders, she says, glancing at Shane. We'll discuss this alone. Retrieving the body was a mistake. Glaring at her, I shake my head. Her family is not going to wonder what happened to her for the rest of their lives. They're going to have a body to bury. Do you think I'd let anyone else go through what I went through? The wondering? The thousands of hours spent wishing I knew what really happened? When we get to shore, I'm calling the police, and in the morning, I'm going to talk to her family. To tell them in person, you can't do that. Of course I can. I'm not 110 pounds. You can't shove me overboard and make me disappear. This can't be reported. Not as a murder. Not even as an accident where a blonde coed went overboard. Daddy doesn't allow sex scandals to surface. It has to be kept secret. The Hayworth name, fuck off, I whisper. Her family is going to know what happened. I owe her that. Chapter 50. Declan. When we're a mile from shore, my aunt tries to go down the steps into the cabin. Shane puts an arm across the passageway to block her. Not gonna happen. We can't take the body back. We cannot have that. In life, we reap what we sow. I say softly, you're vicious and heartless. Don't expect sympathy. I'm all out. You will not do this, Declan, because if you do, I'll just say you were the one who killed her. Who do you think they'll believe? Shane grabs Lizzie's arm and drags her out onto the deck. When he returns, he stands between the helm and the steps to the cabin, acting as sentry. Glancing back, I nod grimly. Thanks. Not a problem. It hasn't been raining for a while, so my aunt removes her slicker and hooks a line through it so it'll hang to dry. She has layers of wool clothes on to keep her warm, unlike Cameron, who must have been so cold. I clench my jaw, feeling sick at the thought. I should have found her sooner. My aunt turns and stares at me. I ignore her imploring look, focusing on the shoreline instead. Without warning, she breaks into a run, grabs the rail, and jumps over. My hands drift away from the controls, and I stare at the deck, shocked. Jesus. I slow the ship and look back at Shane. Liz jumped overboard. Good. I'd leave her. If she makes it back to shore, she does. If not, all the better. My mind is too busy collapsing in on itself for me to think clearly. Flipping on the spotlights on either side of the yacht, I shake my head. I throttle back so the motor idles, and then I go out on deck. Walking along the rail, I peer down to see if she's clinging to anything on the side. Unless she's holding on underwater, the answer is no. I swivel the spotlights. Searching. The surface of the water is relatively smooth. I don't see any sign of her. Because we were in motion when she jumped, I take a flashlight to the back and scan the water behind us. With a cock of my head, I listen. There are no panicked cries for help. Everything is calm and quiet. Was this the way it was after she pushed them overboard? Or did my mom beg her sister to throw her a line? What about Cameron? Did she beg for her life? The one she will never get to lead? Icy pain washes over me like a wave. Flicking off the flashlight, I turn and walk back to the steed's controls. I glance at the map with its glowing path to shore and push the throttle forward. If my aunt reaches the shore alive, she does. If she doesn't, she wasn't meant to. Either way, I never want to lay eyes on her again. Shane gets on the dock and we get the yacht tied off. He doesn't offer to bring Cameron's body ashore, although I know he would if I asked him to. Maybe I should. A sense of detachment has settled in, but there's no guarantee the tidal wave of emotions won't drown me again when I look at her. My jaw tightens, and I hesitate, staring at the rail and the black water beyond. Toughen the fuck up. Cameron's the one who lost her life. Your fucking job is to take care of her body until it's out of your hands. Then, and only then, can you drink yourself into a coma or whatever you need to do. A moment later, I walk down the three steps into the cabin with no recollection of crossing the deck. Drawing slow breaths, I pull the covers back. Her body will be rigid by now, and I brace myself for the impact that will have on me. Her blue lips and mottled skin make me draw back. Fuck. My stomach's in knots. Come on. Let's go. I maneuver her into the blanket and tuck and tie it so it won't fall open as I lift her. She's not rigid yet, which makes it easier. The pain and grief are back as I cradle her body against me. How many times have I carried her? Under better circumstances, too many to count. Ascending the steps, I try not to dwell on the fact that this is the last time. My mind needs a task, any task. A ruffle of air on the underside of my jaw causes me to stop. I stand frozen in the small passageway, knowing I probably imagined the feeling, but the ship's power is off, so there is no air blowing from the vents. Another wispy breath tickles my skin, and I jerk into action, striding out onto the deck where I set her on a bench. My fingers press under her jaw and wait. For several seconds, nothing. Then there's a small thump against my fingertips. Cameron, I say, shaking her shoulders. Cammy, can you hear me? Deck, Shane says from somewhere behind me. He's reboarded. I felt a pulse. I move aside. Feel. Check. Shane puts his fingers against her neck. Don't press too hard. It's faint and slow, really slow. Fuck. Shane says with a sharp nod. Move, I say, brushing him aside. I have to get her to a hospital. Scooping her up, I rush across the deck and down the gangway. Her head thumps against my chest as I carry her to the car. Shane reaches it first and opens the passenger door. I drop into the seat, and as soon as Shane's in the driver's seat, he starts the car and turns the heat all the way up. As we head to Fox Grove Memorial, I try not to get my hopes up. She may have been pulseless for too long for her brain to recover. If she goes into a persistent vegetative state, it'll be worse than if she died. I'm praying that doesn't happen. I shouldn't try to make deals with God. Of all people, I don't deserve to ask for more favors. But I can't stop myself. In my head, I pledge hundreds of things. If only she wakes up and is still herself.
Chapter 51. Cameron. When I wake this time from dying, I'm not in a guest room at Hayworth House. And Declan is not sitting next to me keeping watch. Instead, I'm alone in the ICU. It's dark, and there are tubes and wires everywhere, including one down my throat that hurts and makes me gag. I feel woozy, and it takes a while for me to work up the strength to raise my hand. No one is close enough to see. Wrapping my fingers around the tube, I pull. At first, it doesn't move. I have to jerk on it. The moment it slides free, alarms blare. Gasping for breath, I blink as overhead lights come on. Medical personnel arrive to huddle around me, smiling and speaking excitedly. I want to tell them I'm all right, just tired. But when I speak, my voice is so faint and raspy, it's hard for them to hear. It doesn't sound like me. Many things happen quickly. A physician comes to do an assessment, and my medications are adjusted so my grogginess lifts. They tell me I've been in the ICU for 2 days. They explain I was in a boating accident. The term they keep using is near drowning. I can't remember the accident. The last thing I remember is a horrible fight with Declan. Apparently, a lot happened after that because they tell me he was the one who pulled me from the river and brought me to the hospital. It doesn't make sense to me that we would have been on the water. It's December. Why would we go boating?
Declan, I've been in the ICU waiting room for so long that I've gotten used to sleeping in a blue recliner near the windows. The hospital staff only lets Cameron's mom and adult sister visit her bedside, but people have kept me updated. There's been no change, but she's holding her own. The plan is for Cameron to be moved to a hospital in Boston in the morning, but until then, her mom and sister are allowing me to pay for their hotel accommodations. I asked them to let me help them financially. There were no conditions, but it's had the added benefit that they speak to me and give me details about her. I haven't told them the whole truth yet, but I will, eventually. I'm not ready for them to blame me and my family because then they might not talk to me about what's happening. Not knowing would be too hard. I'm not sure I could take it. She's all I think about. When I check my phone, I've got a text from Shane. I should go by his place to talk to him about Cooper. After Shane dropped us at the hospital, he went to some undisclosed location to finish his questioning of the security officer. I don't know if Cooper's alive or dead, and I don't care. Shane did confirm what I already knew. Cooper helped my aunt abduct Cameron. While I was paying Cooper to protect her, he took a payoff to assist in her murder. I wonder how many times my aunt and uncle have paid him for wet works in the past. I'm sure this wasn't the first time. A pair of ICU nurses are returning from a break, and one strolls over. I sit up, running a hand through my disheveled hair. I'll go home in the morning to shower and shave, but not until she's on her way to Boston. With a bright smile, Cammy's nurse, Flo, says,
"She's awake."
Coming to my feet instantly, I ask, "Can I see her?"
"Not yet."
My heart thuds in my chest. How is she? Not scared, I hope.
"She's disoriented,"
Flo says with a head tilt. Her spiky hair doesn't shift a millimeter. Right now, the sedation's still wearing off, so she's foggy. But the tube is out, and she's talking a bit. It's fantastic. We'll watch her closely until morning, and if everything goes well, they'll discontinue her lines. They may even move her to a regular room. Once she's out of the ICU, you'll be able to see her. Will you tell her I'm here? The nurse nods with a smile. I'm sure her mom will, too. We've called her, and she'll be here as soon as morning visiting hours start. I appreciate everything you've done.
Oh, we're happy to do it. A major win like this is the whole reason I became a nurse.
Flo waves and walks back to the heavy automatic doors. Walking to the windows, I look out over the small downtown, feeling like the weight of the world has been lifted from my shoulders. Now I just need to see her, so I can put things right between us. Chapter 52. Declan. 2 days pass, in which Cameron reportedly improves.
I don't see for myself because her visitor list is still restricted to family. Her phone was lost at sea. I pay for a replacement, but my texts to her still go unanswered. I tell myself to give it some time. The important thing is that she's out of her coma. I stop camping out at the hospital. Instead, I start to move forward with my own plans, returning to Hayworth House to execute my exit strategy. It's a new year. Time to start a new life. In the front hall, I hand Briggs an envelope filled with cash.
"What's this?"
he asks.
"You gave me an excellent Christmas bonus already."
"Yeah. That's severance, unfortunately. Thank you for getting me through this last season. Your skills in the kitchen are exceptional. I wouldn't have lasted on that eating plan with anyone else cooking for me. I appreciate it." He stares at me, and then glances at the bundle of unassembled cardboard boxes that lean against the wall.
"I don't understand, sir."
"My life has taken a couple of hard right turns," I say with a small smile. "So this is our last 2 weeks.
But there must be a way to work something out."
I blow out a breath and shrug. "Not straight away. I wish. Believe me." I extend a hand, and he shakes it.
"I'm not satisfied with this outcome,"
he says, sounding like me.
"I'd like the opportunity to propose a different arrangement. One that would allow me to continue on with you."
"Briggs, you're an exceptional talent. I've mentioned to a couple people that you're going to be available, and there's a lot of interest already. Demand for your services will be high."
"I understand. But I still like the opportunity to explore options that would keep my employment with you."
"Considering the kind of employer I've been, I don't understand why he'd want to stay, especially when he could command a higher salary elsewhere." "Of course you can pitch. I'd love to see it work out." Grabbing the flattened boxes and the roll of packing tape behind them, I head to the stairs. The front gate buzzes, and I pause as Briggs answers.
"Hayworth House," Briggs says.
"Harrison Hayworth, open the gate."
"Yes, sir."
Briggs presses the button to admit my grandfather and then glances at me.
"Library?"
"Sure." I prop the boxes against the staircase and set the tape on the third step. "Go ahead and make coffee," I say, walking back to the front hall. "I'll open the door for him." Briggs sets the severance pay envelope on a console table before hustling down the hall to the kitchen to prepare a tray. I open the door and decide my grandfather's looked better. He's tall and distinguished in his bespoke suit, but the circles under his eyes are darker than usual, and his light blue eyes look sunken. He removes his coat, and I lead the way to the library. As we walk, he catches sight of the boxes and pauses. Inside the library, I wait until he's chosen his seat before taking one across from him. I'm on the couch right below the nymph painting, which, as ever, brings on thoughts of her.
"It's premature to make a move,"
he says. I'm silent, doing exactly what he taught me to do in tense negotiations. He steeples his fingers.
"You should remain in Hayworth House."
"Did Tori refuse the offer?" I ask, surprised.
"No, I haven't made it. I spent some time reflecting, as I asked you to do. I came to the conclusion that you and I both reacted more strongly than was warranted."
The tenor of the discussion was certainly more emotional than usual. Setting my arm on the back of the couch, I finger the edge of the frame. But each of us is capable of making sound decisions quickly, even in high-stakes situations. Looking back, I don't fault us for the rapid closure.
"As a negotiation, no. That's not an issue."
His eyes rise to the painting for a moment.
"I'd forgotten that piece was here. It's one of your grandmother's favorites."
"Yeah. Mine too."
"I understand it's your intention to go without personal security. It's too dangerous, Declan."
"I don't think so. And in any case, I can't afford it long term." He holds up a hand in protest.
"Let's table any discussion of that sort of change for now."
Your security team will continue to be covered by the family rather than by personal assets. No, hear me out, he says calmly, tipping his interlaced fingers toward me. Even if you never become the CEO of Hayworth, you'll certainly eventually have a board position. And business aside, you're the only grandchild Odette and I will ever have. We are not willing to leave your safety to chance. I don't deny that I'll take a board position, even though I'm not convinced I will. I want to run my own show, not be a member of the chorus. But I do recognize the difficulty of his position. He's lost two daughters, and I'm all he's got left of his direct line. If you want to contribute funds, you may, I say with a shrug. But from now on, I'll be arranging my personal security team myself. Stryker is the best.
We vetted them thoroughly.
Not thoroughly enough, I think bitterly. My grandfather presses on.
I understand that you feel I overstepped by soliciting information about your movements going forward. Your privacy will be better respected.
I prefer to do my own vetting.
As you wish.
But unless you can do that immediately, let's reinstate Stryker temporarily so there will be no gaps in coverage. There's enough upheaval right now. I need to be assured of your safety. Again, I fall silent. I haven't told anyone what really happened on the night I pulled Cameron from the river. For all I know, my grandfather has no idea that Liz is dead. For him, she may just be one more missing person. Like my mother. And like Brock. Hayworth family members are a diminishing resource. I'll consider that. I have one man in my employ until the end of January. Let me think about it. I'll reach out with a figure.
Good. We'd also prefer for you to stay in Hayworth House throughout your time at Granthorpe.
I don't know if that's possible. My thoughts drift to Cameron. I'm still looking for a reconciliation, and she might not be comfortable resuming things while I'm living in a house that's a constant reminder of my family.
Why wouldn't it be possible?
He asks. Personal reasons. I'll see. There's a flash of impatience in his eyes, and he narrows them.
I understand you feel betrayed by my suggestion that I might endorse someone else as my successor, but I hope you won't become petty in your bitterness.
A rueful chuckle escapes. You mistake me. I'm not bitter. He scrutinizes me.
You mistake me, is what your great-grandfather used to say.
You must have picked up that phrase from me. Must have. One of many things, I say, offering him a small smile.
Tell me how I'm mistaken, Declan.
Hayworth House underwent several renovations, specifically to suit you, and it's been home to every Hayworth who's attended Granthorpe. Your plan to let it stand empty while you live somewhere else? How should I interpret that as anything other than a move made out of spite? It's not spite. The move would be a shift to a more independent identity. I lick my lips and lean forward. I'm grateful for the time and energy you spent teaching me and raising me after my mother died. I have faith that I'll make a success of my life, whether that's with our family's corporation or elsewhere. On a personal level, things between us are all right. I love you and consider you the most important mentor I'll ever have. His brows rise. We don't often say the words, I love you, to each other. I can't remember the last time either of us used that word.
Losing Emmanuel was a hardship, he says. Raising you was not.
I smile. It feels good to return to the warm feelings we had for each other. I like to think that, on the whole, she'd be happy with how we handled things after she was gone.
She would be proud of you.
Rightly so, he says, his voice softening. He looks away, and I'm surprised to see the depth of emotions playing over his features.
She'll be happy if you take over the reins at Hayworth one day. So we must make that happen.
He clears his throat.
It's still what I want. So from now on, I won't issue ultimatums about your personal life. Clearly a bridge too far.
Yes. But it did me some good.
Rubbing my shoulder absently, I think about the fight Cameron and I had. I become far too comfortable in my arrogance. Having my dreams threatened made me realize how out of line I was for dismissing someone else's. Pressing my lips together, I glance back at the painting. Lesson learned. His gaze fixes on me and holds. There must be something extraordinary about the girl. I incline my head slowly. She draws out a version of me that was buried for a long time. A better, less cynical version. One I missed.
Chapter 53. Cameron. Bits of memory emerge like seashells on a deserted shore. Three moments exist in my mind that turn my blood as cold as the river. One is G.I. Joe security, Cooper, stabbing me in the arm with a needle. The second is having my clothes cut off on the cold, hard deck of a boat, while I flopped around like a fish because my wrists were trapped behind me. The third is of Liz Hayworth's gaunt white face above mine, looking skeletal and menacing. The image causes me to shudder. I didn't accidentally fall off a boat while on a night cruise with Declan. Apparently, that's what he said or implied, because the medical staff and my own family have no idea about the kidnapping and attempted murder. Declan is protecting his security team and his deranged aunt, probably to avoid a scandal. I don't contradict what he's said. I'm not ready to talk about it. Maybe when all of my memory comes back and I'm healed from the ordeal, I'll go to the police, but not yet. After I'm discharged, I spend a few days in Boston recovering physically. But the secrets I'm carrying make me feel isolated and restless. I don't want to linger in the role of near-drowning victim. So I drive back to Foxgrove and GU. En route, my phone buzzes, and I wonder whether it's Declan. He texts every day asking to see me. No doubt he wants to gauge how much I've remembered, and he likely wants to offer me money to stay quiet. It cuts at my heart. Twice I was almost killed, and he still cares more about protecting his family and his privacy than about getting justice for me. Maybe I should feel grateful that he rescued me at all. He could have decided I was too much of a liability and left me dead in the water. While I was hospitalized, I told the staff I only wanted my immediate family to visit. But I was nervous Declan might force his way in. So far, he hasn't. Perhaps he doesn't want to push his luck. I hope so, because maybe that will continue to keep him at bay. My family thinks he's a hero. I'm familiar, of course, with how charismatic he can be. When Taylor tells me that she and Declan are texting, I warn her that he and his family are dangerous. Even so, she doesn't seem to take the hint that there's a reason I'm not comfortable. Instead, she ticks off all of the things he's paid for since the accident. She suggests we invite him to Mom's house so I can talk to him with her around in case I need her. Unbelievable. I'm glad to get away from her, too. Let Taylor and Declan text if they want to. I don't need to hear about it. Once I'm home and locked in my apartment, I check the backyard to be sure it's empty. It looks quiet and peaceful. So far. Opening my wardrobe, I frown at all the expensive clothes that came from my time with Declan. I should put them in a resale shop or donate them. But I can't bring myself to do it yet. Going to my dresser, I open drawers. My jeans and sweatshirts don't appeal to me right now. I don't want to disappear into the crowd, as though I'm insignificant. One thing I witnessed with Declan was that the clothes make the man. He dresses to impress, and people know to treat him with more respect than the average college student. I take out a pair of jeans, but I pair them with a silky cognac-colored blouse. Adding earrings and a little makeup lifts my mood, too. I'm not the same girl I was. Showing something different to the world seems appropriate. Donning a suede duster jacket, I admire myself in the mirror. I look pretty good for a dead girl.
Declan. Sliding from the bench at the kitchen table, I tell Briggs I'll take the rest of my coffee with me. Of course, he says, pouring a fresh cup into a ceramic to-go container. Taking it from him, I glance down at my pocket, where my phone buzzes. Thank you, Briggs. As I pull my phone out, I walk to the front door. Taylor, Cammy drove back there today. Taylor, I'll probably come for weekend if you tell me where you'll be sat. I'll steer us your way. Declan, thanks for letting me know. Glad she's feeling well enough to attend class. Not sure about my weekend plans. Take care. Taylor may have gotten the wrong idea from all the texting we've done over the past few days. I only texted with questions about Cameron, so I didn't think there would be confusion about where my interest lies. And maybe there isn't, I tell myself. When I think about what Cammy would think if she heard my thoughts, I bet she'd say something sarcastic about my assumption that everyone wants me. Cammy. Good. I'm trying to use that nickname in my head so I don't slip and call her Rin again. As I drive to campus, I dictate a text to Shane. We're meeting for lunch, and I suggest the deli in the lobby of Columbus Tower. I've never eaten there before, but it's a frequent lunch spot for the dispatch staff because it's just an elevator trip down from GDD's offices. Shane will know instantly why I'm suggesting it, but he won't call me out on that score. He hasn't mentioned Cameron the past few days, but he knows where my head is. He saw me get embarrassingly emotional on the deck of the ship when I thought she was dead, and he knows I camped out at the hospital almost around the clock when she was in a coma. Shane. Sure, see you there in 10. I park and head into Cohen's Deli. Realizing immediately I've miscalculated, the seating is limited and every table is full. I'm slipping. Normally, I would have had someone call ahead to hold a table for me, but the thought of seeing her is too big a draw. I won't leave. Several people wave and some come over to congratulate me on winning the Palmetto Bowl. I smile and shake hands, moving up in the line as it progresses. Avery and Shane arrive, and his quick glance around causes him to quirk a brow at me. There's a lounge area nearby, Avery says. I saw an open couch. Why don't I grab it? Shane, can you get me a Reuben and vinegar chips? He nods and joins me in line. Are we here for deli meats? Shane asks casually. I glance around at all the people who might eavesdrop. That's the official story. The corners of his mouth curve up. Okay. Because if we were here to catch up with our friends who write for GDD, I would have mentioned that a couple of them are on the south side of the lobby. Without a word, I walk out, leaving Shane in line alone. The second I spot her, my heart clenches like it's forgotten how to beat. She looks incredible. Not just beautiful, which she always is, but also sophisticated and professional. Eric still hasn't gotten his hair cut, and it hangs over his shoulders now. The hair, the beard, and his rugged coat and worn jeans make him look like a Danish boat captain who's just returned after months at sea. When Cameron sees me approaching, an expression of unease crosses her face. Noting her furrowed brow, Eric's expression hardens as he turns his head. Hey, I say to her, I was hoping to run into you. We're on deadline, she says quickly as she takes a step backward. It's my first day back, so I need to get up to the office. Eric falls in step with us as I follow her to the elevator. I'm sure you can spare 5 minutes to talk with me. When the doors of the elevator car open, I step inside with her and block the entrance. Grab the next one, Eric. No, she blurts as her hand shoots past me to grab the sleeve of Sorensen's coat. Come with us. The closing door bangs against his forearm and then reopens. Oh, there's Avery, Cameron says. Let me out. I want to say hello to her. Eric's glacial blue gaze shifts between the two of us. He pushes my arm aside so Cameron can exit. My brows rise as it dawns on me that she's afraid to be alone with me. I'm gutted. It's not the same devastation I felt when I thought she was dead, but it's something akin to that. All I can do is stare at her retreating back as the doors close.
I stand inside the unmoving elevator, just as frozen. After a few moments, the doors open again. Shane must have pressed the call button because he's standing in front of the doors. One look at my face tells him something. I'm not sure what. He waves for me to step out.
You know, it's hard to form words. I'll catch up with you later. Deck, later, I mumble, pushing past him and cutting to the building's front entrance. I finally get it. She is not mine anymore.
Cameron. What the fuck is going on? Shane demands, glowering at me. Wait, Avery says, putting a hand in the middle of his chest. He doesn't budge. In fact, he leans closer. So he's towering above me and making himself even more intimidating. Shane, Avery says sharply, trying to get him to back away. Narrowed green eyes look at me with disgust. What the hell did you say to him? My spine stiffens and my tone is curt. I said I'm too busy to talk. You're unbelievable. And so fucking ungrateful. Shane shakes his head. If you don't love him, all right. But you could let him down easy. He was ready to die for you. Even when he thought you were dead, he stayed in that freezing fucking water for way too long. Because he couldn't leave you out there alone. Blinking up at him, I try to piece together what he's telling me. My mind races. What are you saying? Do you really not know? Shane's jaw works as he grinds his teeth. Declan walked away from a billion-dollar birthright like it was nothing. For you. He takes a breath and lowers his voice so it's less aggressive. He risked his life, his freedom, everything to find and rescue you. And you just treated him like none of that matters. Which is pretty fucking heartless. He blows out a breath. Is that really who you are, Cammy?
Declan. ESPN is on, but I don't hear the commentary. My thoughts are looping in a spiral of surprise and regret. It breaks my heart to know I've lost her. But after all that happened, I suppose it was presumptuous to think she'd want to try again. I swallow and rub my jaw. I have to let her go completely. But that's a cause for worry. If she's not with me, I can't protect her. Brock is still out there. So is Casanova. Maybe they're one and the same. Cameron needs security. I'm using a new firm, but considering what happened with Cooper, she's not likely to allow me to send a detail. Rubbing my eyes, I grimace. I hate to think of her being alone. It'll tear me apart if someone hurts her. Even if I can't have her, I want her to be safe. Briggs taps on the door frame and leans into the library. Miss Reynolds to see you. Are you available, sir? For the second time in as many hours, I'm shocked to the point of speechlessness. Briggs waits. Finally, I nod. Yes, put her in the front room. I'll be out in a minute. In a slight fugue, I stand and turn off the television. I guess she's coming to tell me to stop texting since I refused to take the hint when she ghosted me. Maybe this is the price of a miracle. She's alive, but she's about to school me on exactly how overblown my ego is. So be it. I get it now. Cameron blames me for what happened to her. My family is poison, and I've been that way too. After our fight and what my aunt did, she no longer trusts me. Understandable. The walk down the hall feels like a death march. In the front room, Briggs talks to her with a look of concern on his face. You can stay, Briggs, if Miss Reynolds would prefer it. Briggs's brows jump up in surprise. No, he says softly. I'll be in the kitchen. He hustles out of the room. Remaining in the doorway so she doesn't feel crowded by me, I say, I'm sorry for not getting the message sooner. My voice sounds completely normal. Another surprise. I won't text again. When she turns toward me, there are tears spilling over her lashes. And I freeze. All the air in my lungs seems to evaporate as I stare at her. I want to comfort her.
but getting close might be overstepping. Do you want to sit down, or I'm fine to stand? She rubs her arms with her hands and draws in a long breath, like she's struggling to breathe, too. I remember parts of what happened, but not everything. I need you to tell me about that night. Her voice is firm, but it has a slight raspiness that's new. Your voice is different. It's from the breathing tube. Right. Being attached to the ventilator machine damaged her vocal cords. Will it get better? Maybe. Does it hurt? No. She tilts her head. I'm okay, Declan. I just want to hear what happened that night.
Sure. Of course.
I swallow and take a deep breath. They kidnapped you. Cooper assisted my aunt. It turns out he was her fixer on and off for years. I had no idea. I lick my lips. She had you drugged and tried to kill you. Her reasoning for doing that? I still don't completely understand.
You rescued me?
I shrug. I got you out of the water and took you to the hospital. I don't know if rescue is the right word for it.
If you'd left me there, I would have died. So yes, Declan, rescue is the right word.
She credits me with saving her life. That's something, I guess.
Where are they?
She asks.
The security guy and your aunt.
I glance down the empty hall. Gone.
Gone for good?
Drawing in a long breath, I shrug. Admitting they're dead wouldn't be the smartest play, considering Shane and I had a hand in what happened. They'll never hurt you again.
Why didn't you make a police report about what happened?
Lowering my voice to a whisper, I say, I did some terrible things that night. If I'd made a report, it would have led to an investigation.
Is she dead?
She whispers. I press my lips together in a grim line. If Cameron is afraid my aunt will target her again, I want to reassure her that won't happen. Presumably, yes. She went overboard into the freezing water. The swim was over a mile, and the tides weren't favorable. I didn't call the Coast Guard to help her, and afterward, there were no reports of any rescues that night. The waves, okay, she says, cutting me off gently.
Shane helped you, right?
I frown. Implicating myself is one thing. No, I acted alone. Shane wasn't with me. No one was. My heart thuds hard enough to rattle my ribs. It's all right if you want to make a police report, I say softly. Do whatever feels right to you.
Cooper the fixer, where is he?
I exhale a sound that's half sigh and half rueful amusement. I think I'll take the fifth. Might as well get some practice in. After a beat, I add, I will say, just between us, that Cooper's not coming back. Ever. She brushes her damp cheek.
You've been texting for days.
Was it so we could get our stories straight? My brows knit.
No. So what did you want to say?
My heart bangs against my ribs until the sound echoes in my ears. It doesn't matter. I'm glad you're all right. One light brow rises sardonically.
Is that really the best you can do?
My own brows rise in surprise. What do you want to hear?
The truth.
Why were you trying so hard to reach me? Shane says you stayed at the hospital all night when I was in the ICU.
Well?
Turning my palms up in an I don't know gesture, I study her face. Apparently, this is the way I act when I fall in love with someone. Definitely over the top. I blow out a breath. It's a relief to be able to say the words to her, but I try to make the admission as casual as possible so she doesn't feel pressure to respond. Be glad you didn't see the worst of it.
What was the worst of it?
I shake my head. I'd rather not say. Her eyes lock with mine.
All right. Keep your secrets. I know how important they are to you. Image over everything, right?
No, definitely not. She tilts her head.
No?
You're sure? I open my mouth, but words fail me. I don't know how to convince her that finding her dead changed me forever. Yes, Cammy, I'm sure. I don't trip over the nickname. That at least is well done. A brief look of surprise appears on her face when it registers that I used the nickname she favors. Then the surprise disappears, and she looks serious again. Maybe one day you'll approve that, she says. My brow cocks, and my heart thuds harder at the challenge. I'm not sure what we're talking about right now. Be specific about what you want me to prove. It's not enough to rescue me in the dead of night. Even if you almost die doing it. Nodding, I take a step forward. Tell me what you want. This is the closest I've been to her in days, not just physically, but in ways that run deeper. This is where I've wanted to be since the fight. I'm not a dirty little secret. Don't ever make me feel like one again. That sobers me. Understood. And I won't. What else? Her phone buzzes. That's probably the GDD editor. I have to go right now. Okay. He's not impressed that I was in a coma, since it wasn't for a big story. A lightness enters her tone. It's almost teasing. Like the way she used to be with me. And it's a total thirst trap. All he seems interested in is that I've missed the last two story meetings. Asshole, I deadpan. You're one to talk, Mr. Blood, Sweat, and Tears only count if they throw you a parade. Fair point, I say with a small smile. When she approaches, I step aside to let her pass, moving my hands behind my back so they won't be tempted to reach out. She pauses as she passes and crooks a finger for me to bend down. I do, clasping my hands tight. Thanks for saving my life. Her lips brush against mine. I'm glad neither of us died that night.
Chapter 54. Cameron. The following night, there's a buzz of excitement in the GDD offices, because there's a rumor circulating that Rickson will no longer be a reporter at large, and that the new standing desk in the corner will be his. At 7:30, we're getting the new issue ready for press when Heinrich comes out of his office. Turning on the large flat screen, he announces, "There's GU coverage on Foxgrove Local 7. The national news media picked up the Casanova story, but many outlets concluded their coverage after Avery killed Take. Reporters from out of town were called home. They'll likely descend again now. Channel 7 begins GU coverage by introducing Eden and Declan, who stand on a path leading into campus. Eden wears a GU blazer and her dance team javelin pin. Declan wears a navy suit with a bronze and navy tie. The reporter explains that in addition to being student athletes, Eden and Declan come from families with a long history at Granthorpe. The TV reporter shares that GU has received a generous endowment from the Buchanan, Hayworth, and Ralston families that will be used in part to blanket the campus with lights and security cameras. There will also potentially be around-the-clock monitoring of the enhanced system when it goes live. The reporter pushes the mic in front of Eden. Difficult news recently with the discovery of Isabel Long's body. How are you holding up? Eden's expression shudders as she acknowledges how sad and unsettling the heartbreaking development is. The mic tips toward Declan. Declan, your family practically founded this school. It has to be upsetting to see the effect Casanova has had on campus life. Is that why your family is investing millions in additional security? Declan stares into the camera with his mesmerizing eyes. For me, it's become personal. He pauses, as if he's looking directly at me. My girlfriend is a student here. And one night when she was on campus alone, there was an incident. She's fine, but it was a scary situation. I was fortunate that I didn't lose the person I loved that night. Others haven't been as lucky. Granthorpe should be a safe place for every student. That's something that my great-grandfather believed. And it's what I believe as well, very strongly. You mentioned a girlfriend. Who is that? Her name is Cameron Reynolds. Oh my God. She's an investigative journalist, Declan continues. So hopefully she won't mind that I've made us Channel 7 News official. I'm sure she won't, the reporter says as they share a small laugh. We wish you all the best. My gaze remains glued to the screen as the reporter asks Eden a follow-up question. But my brain doesn't process what's being discussed. Slowly, I become aware that everyone in the newsroom is looking at me rather than the screen. Yeah, I murmur, shaking my head. So that happened. There's a smattering of laughter, and then Heinrich, possibly taking pity on me, barks that the layout for the second page is still not correct. That leads to everyone returning to their workstations. Leaning over my desk, I allow myself to smile. Deep down, I'm elated that Declan made us nightly news official. And the way he did it strikes me as kind of perfect. Sweet without being sappy. He's great on camera, completely at ease. My phone buzzes. Declan. I had a thing to do on campus tonight. May I bring you dinner? He had a thing. Understatement of the year. I want to say, yeah, I saw your thing. But I don't, because I'm not ready to talk about it yet. I'm still unpacking. And I'm starting to realize that, for me, that interview was three bombshells in one. Declan called me his girlfriend and referred to me as someone he loves. My face flushes, and I turn away from the newsroom until I'm sure I won't burst into flames. He also mentioned I'm an investigative reporter. The personal stuff is huge, but publicly acknowledging my career choice is a big move, too. He seems to be showing me he's ready to accept what I do, more than accept, actually. Declan is too savvy not to realize that by mentioning my career plans in a televised interview, he's helping me network in my field. The more his words hit me, the more overwhelmed I feel. As I try to compose myself, I stare at his text. I want to see him. I'm not sure he knows I'm working in the GDD offices tonight. He probably does. He knows a lot of things. Cameron. Are you near the tower? I'm working, but can come down for a few. Declan. Sure. I'll text when I'm in the lobby. About 10 minutes later, the door to the newsroom opens, and Declan and Briggs stroll in carrying bags and boxes. My jaw drops. Good evening, everyone, Briggs says. A little sustenance courtesy of Hayworth House. We appreciate the important work you're doing. Oh my God. And the grand gestures just keep coming. Several people hop up to help clear a table for them to unload the spread. Like a magician, Declan pulls a bouquet of flowers and a small gift bag from one of the larger bags. He crosses the room with nearly every eye following him. Hello, he says, laying the flowers across my keyboard. Yeah, hey. I can feel myself flushing again. It's annoying as hell. I spoke to the dean about a Valentine's Day parade to celebrate the campus's best love stories. Would you like us to be on the first float or the last one? My eyes widen. Please tell me you're kidding. The corner of his mouth twitches and a smirk appears. I am. Don't have to be, though. If you're a big fan of Valentine's Day. I shake my head. And then my hands, because they're trembling. I saw the news. He nudges the gift bag in my direction. This is for you. My eyes dart around the room, where many people have settled at their desks with plates of food and are now watching us. How about if I open it later? I say softly. Coward, he whispers as his smirk deepens. Did you or did you not challenge me to go public? Yes, but I didn't expect this. Why not? Go big or go home is woven into my DNA. So is discretion. A flash of a smile lights up his handsome face for a moment. True. He pulls a plastic bag from the gift bag and sets it on my desk. Handmade chocolates, courtesy of Briggs. In case you want to share with your colleagues. He winks and turns away. I watch him cross the newsroom and exit through the main door. After a beat, I rush to follow him out. He stands at the elevator, waiting for the car to come. Declan? He turns to face me and nods. Thank you for dinner. And for the news. It means a lot to me. Good, he says. You don't need to do anything else. This was enough. His smile fades and he nods, turning serious. Before the night on the yacht, I'd been trying to downplay what you mean to me, which I should have known better. When I pulled you from the water, I thought you were dead, and it wrecked me. He licks his lips. Lesson learned. His gaze moves over me slowly. So now, if you or anyone needs to hear me say I'm in love with you, all they have to do is ask. Oh my God. I'll never admit it out loud, but a part of me melts like a handmade chocolate. My heart hammers in my chest, and I shift my weight on the balls of my feet. Looking up at him, I say, "For someone who has never been in love before, you're pretty good at it." It's my turn to lick dry lips. "Would you like a kiss?"
"Hell yes."
Rising on my toes, I kiss him. The way our tongues touch is a familiar blend of sexy and sweet. His arm slides around my waist, lifting me off the ground and pressing me against him. It all feels heart-stoppingly good. I'd almost forgotten how in sync our bodies can be. Eventually pulling away, I drag in a breath. I have to go back.
"If I let you go, will you promise to spend the night with me?"
"Yes."
"If I let you go, will you promise to spend the year with me?"
I chuckle. "Probably." His mouth presses a rough kiss on mine. And then he sets me back on my feet.
"I'll wait for you downstairs."
"You don't have to. I can drive over to your place when we're done here."
"Walk to your car alone? No. I'll be in the lobby."
"Okay." As I back away, I smile. "Also, I appreciate your willingness to use the L word first. I'm going to brag about that for the rest of my life."
"Do what you need to do," he says.
As I stroll back toward the newsroom, there's a broad smile on my face. A moment later, the building's power goes out, plunging us into darkness. I stiffen as the memory of being pulled across the cold deck of the boat hits me. "Jesus, Declan." My voice is breathless and anxious.
"Right here, Cam."
His hand finds me in the darkness, and strong arms close around me.
"I've got you."
The tension in my spine eases. I'm safe. Another memory hits me. The yacht rolling on the waves. I lean closer to Declan, absorbing his warmth. Liz Stowe's last words to me slice across my brain like a blade. "Be glad I didn't leave you for Casanova. You were on his list."
This is the end of Wicked Demands, a Podium Audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we would love for you to rate and review it. For more contemporary dark romance, check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also, consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to Wicked Demands, Book 2 of Dark Nights, produced by Troy Oti, written by Marley Ray, performed by Michael Pierce and Ramona Master. Text copyright 2023 by Marley Ray. Production copyright 2023 by Podium Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.